Okay, welcome everyone to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is March 28th, 2017. We're going to mix up the order a little bit because I see some people here who can testify and then get ready to go. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2930. Representative Boone. Yeah, Kathy, could you read the summary, please?
House Bill 2930 requires Department of Human Services and law enforcement agencies to make efforts to determine the military status of parents or guardians of a child who is subject to the report of child abuse. The bill requires DHS or law enforcement agency to notify the Oregon Military Department and the U.S. Department of Defense Family Advocacy Program if there is a report of child abuse or if DHS or the law enforcement agency is conducting a child abuse investigation with reasonable cause involving a child whose parent or guardian is in the military.
Good morning, Chair Kennegeier, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Boone. I represent House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast of Oregon. And I'm here today. I've worked with Mark Sansusti, who you'll know, no relation to your analyst.
Cousins.
I've worked with Mark for many years, mostly in the emergency prep and veterans arena. So he comes from Department of Defense, and we've been friends for a long time, and he asked me to submit this bill here in Oregon. It's part of his territory, so I'm going to let him give the rest of it. And he gets all the questions.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Vice Chairs and Committee. For the record, my name is Mark Sansusti. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwestern States, based out of Tacoma. And Oregon happens to be one of my states, and I worked with Representative Boone and some of y'all for the last few years. I work for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, Military Community Family Policy, and there are eight of us that cover the states doing these types of things. And I'm here to express support for House Bill 2930 and try and explain it. First of all, I'd like you to know, and the DHS person who may follow me, that this is not a reflection of any known problem in Oregon with any Oregon state agency having to do with children and families and the military in this state. What this is, however, is a recognition that within the Department of Defense, we found problems in states because of the present system that often relies on individual local MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding, to deal with it. With this child abuse and neglect. And because of that, this issue has risen to make our annual list of pressing concerns to work with legislators at the state level. And since 2015, this has been one of our issues. We have about a dozen issues, lots of breadth and not much depth for people like me sometimes, but that's what this is about. The Secretary of Defense is required by Section 1787 of Title 10 U.S. Code to coordinate with civilian child welfare to obtain information on allegations of child abuse and neglect involving children in military families. If this bill becomes law, it will help us address those issues by providing a consistent and uniform state statute into law that will allow the military installations to know this unfortunate situation has occurred. It lets the military chain of command know and allows a family that may have an allegation of child abuse and neglect to seek the medical and counseling services the military installations provide. And it also, of course, in the interest of a child, prevents anybody from slipping through the cracks. You may know or not that 70% of military families live off a military installation, and outside the installations out in the communities. And considering the lack of military installations in the state of Oregon, that percentage is no doubt higher. The military services offer excellent investigative, intervention, and rehabilitative support resources that can assist the child the state child welfare system in addressing allegations. While the current Department of Defense policy described in the Family Advocacy Program is to establish MOUs to operationalize communication and cooperation, we're asking for specific state-level guidance that directs information sharing with the military, and it will provide consistency and complements the language that directs action by the SecDef. Because we've been working this issue in the state since 2015, for the Personnel Readiness Directorate of the DOD, we now have 9 states, and I could name them for you, doing what HB 2930 asks you to consider, and another 7 states plus Oregon taking it up right now in 2017. And what we do is we take the best practice language that is determined by maybe one of the first few states that does this, and then we try and follow it. So now we know that Oregon is not a huge active duty military state, but as of September 2016, according to the Defense Manpower Data Center, Oregon has a total active military of 933 military members, 381 spouses, and 1,563 children ages 5 through 18. We also know that lots of child abuse and neglect occurs from 0 to 5, and I'm still trying to get the numbers to add to that. So it's at least almost 1,600 from 5 to 18, and who knows, we don't know at the moment how many from 0 to 5. The latest Defense Management Data Center data I can find for select reserves indicates 10,455 military members, 4,300 spouses, and 5,112 total dependents. Unfortunately, with this many people in both components, active duty and reserves and guard, and I believe this bill includes everyone, occasionally we know that child abuse happens. And in an August 2016 Department of Defense Family Advocacy Program report for fiscal year 2015, which runs through October 2015, and that's the latest I have, indicates that the DOD rate of individual child victims, it remains half of the rate of the U.S. civilian population. That known, the DOD remains focused on military-specific risk factors and associated prevention strategies that best serves the military family. In fiscal year 15, while incidents decreased 1.4% from fiscal year 14, there is quite an upward trend from fiscal year 09 to fiscal year 14, prompted an enhanced focus on the prevention of child neglect in 2015. Neglect actually continues to comprise the majority of...
If you could wrap it up,
okay.
That would be great.
We've
got a lot
thank
of other
you.
Bills
I'm sorry.
You.
It comprises the majority, 58% of incidents reported. And I think you would agree with me, finally, that regardless of the numbers, every child's life is worth this effort. So thank you for taking up this issue, and thanks for allowing me to kind of explain it, since we're not here pointing fingers, but just looking for your help. Thank you.
Great.
So, Madam Chair,
yes.
Can I just really quick, on OLS, I see that there's a letter that came in from the Chiefs and the Sheriff's Association, Mark, and I just want to read this one paragraph to you off of it really quick and get your response to it. But they have a concern with where the bill is and would, I think, love to work with Representative Boone on moving forward with what you're wanting to do. So one of the most difficult challenges that law enforcement agencies face when receiving a report of child abuse from DHS is the lack of specific information about where the alleged abuse actually occurred. Many times this information is not listed in the report narrative, and additional follow-up is required by investigators simply to determine what law enforcement agency has jurisdiction. And this can be the significant impact, particularly on a smaller agency. So I'm just kind of curious how you weigh in on that.
Through the chair, Representative Olson, the basic things that the bill asks for is for if there's an allegation in a family out in the community, that included in the inquiry is asking the question, are you a family that's military connected in any way? And so number one, it's to find out if they are, and then to report that to the military and the Department of Defense family advocacy people and the military chain of command. And we have we have locations within Oregon, where that would go. I'm not sure if that totally gets to the intent of the question.
I know you want to move forward. No, it doesn't. Okay. But I mean, yeah. This just kind of causes me to realize that, this is a little deeper than what.
We, so to respond to that, thank you. because we're getting near the end, with the encouragement of my vice chair, I'm starting to put more things as public hearing slash work session on the very first time, and that's if there's no issue that comes up, then we would be willing to work it. If there's any issue at all, with at least 3-4 weeks left to go, no reason to do that. So I think it would be great if you would get together with Kevin Campbell representing the sheriffs. Is that right? It might be a very simple, the chiefs, might be a very simple answer, but let's hold off and at least get that response and see if there's any tweak that needs to be made. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. I have two questions.
Go ahead.
Just wanted to double check. If someone who's in Oregon military, if they find out, or if the military finds out that there is a founded abuse accusation against a military member, are there disciplinary actions that the military takes against that individual?
Well, the primary focus is on the counseling and medical services that can be provided. And also, I'm a retired Air Force officer and have been a commander, and there are occasions when those things happen. And yes, there can be disciplinary action taken against a service member if that person has, in fact, been involved in a child abuse and neglect.
Follow up? So, to my understanding, the intent of the bill is just to make sure if someone who's in the military, they know what's going on at home. That's my understanding of the intent. However, I'm concerned about one line that's a little ambiguous. Page 3, line 32, it makes reference, starting in 31, cause to believe that abuse has occurred and it has been determined that the parent or guardian of the child who is the subject of the investigation. Now, right there, it's, in my opinion, ambiguous as to whether it's the guardian, so the parent who's the subject of the investigation, or the child that there's an investigation about, and it, meaning that if they think that the military person, the person who's in the military, is the one who's the subject of the investigation, that this could cause them to have disciplinary actions before there's a true final finding. That makes sense, what I'm trying to say? As opposed to, we think there's may have been abuse on your child, and we're letting you know about it.
Through the chair, Representative Stark, again, from my experience, there wouldn't be any disciplinary action taken until there were findings that were conclusive that these things actually happened. Allegations in and of themselves don't result in having me as a commander doing any kind of disciplinary action for someone with an allegation. At that point, it's just so we know what it's going on in the community and the chain of command knows, and the medical and counseling services can be afforded to them within the military installation.
Okay. Representative Noble, question?
Thank you, Chair. I just have a couple questions. But one, kind of following up on Representative Stark, I'm concerned coming from law enforcement that it may kick off a dual investigation, one, a military investigation. At the same time, there's a civilian investigation. So I would encourage you to work with the chiefs and sheriffs. The other is, and this is probably, I think I know the answer to this, but we have a cross-reporting requirement with the state DHS and law enforcement. If you're asking for reporting to a military department, would the military department be willing to be mandatory reporters and then cross-report back to civilian authorities, which is probably a larger... But just some food for thought as you move forward with this.
Well, through the chair, Representative Noble, to your first point, I had an answer to your first point, but what was it again? Was the question was relative?
First one is dual investigations.
Yes.
You have a military investigation and a civilian investigation
well,
at the same
normally,
time.
Normally when those two things happen, and you might know this already, but one agency or the other agrees that the other one will do it. And most likely in the community, the military police and investigators always, at least in my experience, would defer to the community investigators to do that, and then the results would come back, and maybe we would respond with the counseling or the disciplinary action that would happen. So I'm not sure that I've seen that happen as far as dual investigations, because one abrogates to the other who does it. And your second, yeah.
I think maybe you're getting at mandatory reporting, and I think the answer I heard was yes. A lot of this is to inform the military of what's happening out there's data, but I think as far as the investigation part, if it happens off the base at least, and I'm not sure about on base, but in the community that, you know, police and or DHS, whoever's first cross report, both report, and it starts there. So, and that's to avoid a slip through the cracks. In that sense, I thought you were doing it, you thought I was doing it, that kind of thing. And I'm guessing that, you know, what you just, you did nod when you said, would the military be part of that mandatory reporting to the community investigation, which I, and your first thing was, or maybe it was Representative Stark saying whether it's the parent or the guardian. I think it's either or. It's whether there's a guardian, which would be a child care provider, or grandma or somebody, grandpa, and then, or the parent. So it's whoever's watching the kid, put it that way.
And in, and through the chair, Representative Noble, Washington State was one of the first ones to pass this. I'm up there, and I was involved in this from the beginning. And the state DHS departments up there and the military law enforcement have very close relationships, so that information sharing is something that there was no disagreement about, the willingness to do that kind of thing, cooperate that way.
So thank you very much. We've got three other people to testify on this, who hopefully will be brief because we've got a lot of bills after it. And I am hoping, Representative Noble and perhaps Representative Peluso, you might want to follow up with Kevin Campbell with this group. Yeah. Sounds like it just might need a little bit of clarification. Okay, thank you. So next we have Stacey Ayers, Kevin Neely, and is there a deputy DA here? Okay.
This looks like judiciary now.
Chair Kittengeier, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. In fact, a lot of the discussion that's already occurred really highlights, I think, what we've identified in House Bill 2930. And I've brought with me Brennan Murphy, who's a deputy district attorney from Marion County, in case there are any technical questions. We're, of course, more than happy to work with Mr. Sansusi on the bill. But again, I think we heard some of the concerns on the right side of the dais, at least right side as I look at the dais already. One, we want to make sure that in instances in which there is an active investigation in a case in which the military member may have been accused of some inappropriate actions, we do want to make sure that that investigation doesn't get compromised by this bill. I don't think that's the intention of the sponsors of the bill, so we'll make sure that there's some language on that front. And two, and this gets at what Representative Olson said earlier, that the chiefs and the sheriffs, the whole question of cross-reporting is a challenging issue, and law enforcement regularly gets cross-reports that they don't know what to do with. And we want to make sure we don't compound the problem here. And so I know law enforcement is interested in continuing to work with DHS on finding ways to streamline that cross-reporting so that cases, one, don't fall through the cracks, and two, law enforcement doesn't get overburdened with reports that come in that they can't figure out where the incident occurred and how to proceed with the investigation. So, again, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we'll certainly touch base with the sponsor of the bill to make sure that we can solve these issues.
Right. Chair Kittengeier, Vice Chair Olson, I apologize, I've got a bit of a lingering cold here. Stacey Ayers, I'm the CPS Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. Thanks for allowing me to be here today. I think the concerns that have been expressed, the department shares them. I think the intent of the bill is pretty clear that we want to have communication with the Department of Military and with the family advocacy programs that are available and to get services for folks when they need them, and especially kind of with the needs of the military in all areas as they're coming back, as they're, you know, here, as they're being ready to be deployed, et cetera. So there's no question about the intent this bill being good. I would share Representative Stark's concerns about the different parts of the bill that require notice. So there are two sections in the bill that talk about notice. One is at the allegation stage, and the next one is at the disposition stage. And so potentially run into a problem of if we know that the military department is not going to notify, then we're probably okay. But there's no guarantees of that. So we're happy to work with the sponsor and Mr. Sansouzi about this. So.
Madam Chair, my name is Brendan Murphy. I'm a Marion County Deputy District Attorney. I think that in the interest of time, all of my colleagues have adequately stated the issues as we see them. So.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2930 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2534. Representative Reardon and whoever would like to join him up here. Cassie, could you read the summary, please?
House Bill 2534 establishes the Community Leverage Fund as of January 1st, 2018. The bill directs the Oregon Business Development Department, Business Oregon, to make grants and loans to fund proposals that address outcomes in health, early learning, workforce, and economic development and education. The bill allows cities, counties, school districts, post-secondary institutions, early learning hubs, regional achievement collaboratives, workforce investment boards, or regional solutions advisory committees to apply for grants and loans, and specifies that grants and loans be distributed in substantially equal amounts among economic development regions in the state. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We do have a -2, which replaces the bill and establishes the Oregon Opportunity Commission as of January 1st, 2018. The bill specifies the purpose of the commission to award funds, develop assessment tools, review laws and rules, and identify incentives to address concentrated poverty. The bill specifies commission membership to consist of 19 members, including nonprofit organizations supporting racial minorities and Native American communities. The amendment allows the commission to administer the oath and take depositions and issue subpoenas, and establishes the Oregon Opportunity Fund and continuously appropriates money to the commission. The bill declares the amendment declares an emergency effective on passage.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the House Human Services and Housing Committee, it's a pleasure to be here before you this morning. I'm Jeff Reardon, State Representative for District 48, which includes Southeast Portland, Clackamas, and Happy Valley. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this important bill. Before I get into the bill, I just want to emphasize that we are talking about the -2 amendment, which is drastically different than the original bill. Poverty is something I see every time I drive home. I see the tents underneath the I-205 Foster Road area. I see my struggling students in the local schools and the teachers trying to keep up and helping those kids. I see the RVs parked along the road because they have no place else to go. But I also see my neighbors working very hard, day in, day out, at neighborhood association meetings everywhere, trying to address these problems, which they've been working on for years. You know, someone isn't just in poverty because they simply don't have any money. Poverty is often generational. It affects children hardest. It gets in the way of a person graduating from high school, going on to get their degrees, getting any kind of workforce training. Helps keeps them out of living wage job opportunities and can make them choose between paying bills or buying food. And the list goes on and on. A location affects poverty as well. Are there jobs in the area? Is there affordable housing? Are there community resources? These are all things that can vary from one community to another. And there isn't one thing that the state can do to alleviate and solve poverty. There are many things that might be done, but they need to be customized to the unique needs of the community. So I ask you this morning, who knows a community better than the people living here? Certainly no one person or no government agency does. One of the most effective ways to shift a community from one of concentrated poverty to one of opportunity is to enhance the network of resource sharing and the way the agency/community collaboration and provide resources to support collaborative efforts. lack of capacity to collaborate, inflexible funding streams, burdensome reporting requirements, and lack of coordination of efforts by state agencies make it difficult for communities to take action to alleviate poverty and enhance opportunity. So leveraging public and private efforts and resources can greatly improve the opportunities for communities to improve their situations. House Bill 2534 would allow communities to write their own prescriptions to poverty. It creates the Poverty to Opportunity Commission and Fund, which is made up from leaders of state and federal agencies, leaders from nonprofits, and representatives from communities of concentrated poverty. I'm going to skip some of the details just for the sake of timeliness. My district is one of the highest levels of poverty in the state. It would need different support than what might be needed in Ontario or some other part of the state. But this commission would let communities tell them directly what they needed, and a commission would provide the funding and resources to them. It makes better use of the people's time in that community. They're exhausted. It makes better use and allows the folks that have the resources in the agencies, in the philanthropic organizations, to come together to help in a coordinated way meet the needs of the struggling communities. I urge your support on House Bill 2534 because we've got to find a new way to address communities of concentrated poverty. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, and committee members, my name is Kenneth Thrasher. I'm a retired business person, a member of the Oregon Business Council's Poverty Task Force, and current or past board member of the Children's Institute, Oregon Mentors, College Possible, Friends of the Children, the Oregon Halfway House, and Albertina Kerr Centers. As a person who grew up in a low-income family, started to work at a very young age to meet my basic needs, and had a wonderful mentor in Bill Nato who encouraged me to get a college degree, I both understand poverty and have committed a great portion of my life to improving the lives of children and families in poverty. I really appreciate Representative Reardon's efforts with respect to House Bill 2534 to create a Poverty Opportunity Commission and Fund. It's time for Oregonians to address poverty in a coordinated manner versus the silos of activities that, while great in their intent, don't always maximize the opportunity to reduce poverty in Oregon. A person in poverty, if we don't break the cycle of poverty, will have up to 200 descendants over five generations. We can't afford the compound impact poverty has on our society. By enabling children and families to escape poverty, there's a triple payback. Increasing individual esteem and life outcomes will break the cycle of multi-generational poverty, having a better prepared and productive workforce for tomorrow's jobs, and a reduction in state and local social costs. By coordinating our efforts statewide, we can achieve a significant return on investment. The key, from my perspective, is to better understand local, regional, and state needs for those being served, including subgroups, as one size does not fit all. Combining this with an inventory of resources available will allow us to determine the gaps in services, policy needs, and alternatives to bring required resources to play in filling these needs. House Bill 2534 lays the groundwork for doing this in a very coordinated manner with the right people and organizations at the table. It starts with listening to local community needs through a community needs assessment. My experience with low-income children and families at Earl Boyle's preschool and elementary school in Portland, at the Yonkala preschool near Roseburg, with reentry jobs and housing programs at the Oregon Halfway House, now the Northwest Regional Reentry Center, with mentoring and youth development practices through Friends of the Children, and leveling the playing field for low-income urban and rural students in achieving a four-year college education tells me that coordinated efforts really work. By surveying the needs, improving family and community engagement, blending financial and service resources, developing a strong state and local leadership, and having an accountability system works for these highly successful organizations. How we leverage these best practices and the other state initiatives around job training and employment opportunities, reducing sentencing and reentry programs, health and mental health opportunities, early childhood strategies, and career and post-secondary opportunities can best be done in a coordinated manner. The often negative perception of people in poverty are just that. They're 90% perception and maybe 10% fact. These children and families want to be successful. They want to avoid the many penalties of being poor. They want a good education, want to be healthy and free of stress, and want good jobs that lead to sustainable careers. We can enable that in a coordinated way through House Bill 2534. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Sanchez and Vice Chair Olson, thank you. For the record, my name is Beverly Stein. I'm a senior fellow at the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State. And through my work there, I staff the Oregon Business Council Poverty Task Force.
A former legislator.
A former
as well.
Legislator. Yes.
Yes,
it's a pleasure to be here on this side.
Yeah.
One of the areas of interest of the task force is addressing communities of concentrated poverty. You have my testimony in front of you, so I'm just going to make a few points that I think to augment my testimony, and you can read what I've written. We've researched this topic, and you'll hear from one of my students in a moment about the research that led to this legislation. But the bottom line is that the state can support community-led efforts to address poverty in a much more comprehensive way. The silos of state government and inflexible funding get in the way of local communities being able to actually do the things they know will actually work to address poverty in their community. And we know that communities of poverty, if there are more than 30% of people in poverty in a community, the whole community is going to be affected. So one of the points here is that we need to focus on communities of concentrated poverty as well as individual poverty if we're going to really make a difference in the whole state. And this is in rural and urban areas. The Poverty to Opportunity Commission would be a forum for coordinating, looking at where the state gets in the way of local communities because of the silos and because funding is not leveraged, and looking for policy issues that get in the way of actually making things happen at the local level. I think this is even more important today than it has ever been because we're looking at potential cuts in funding from the federal level to HUD, CDBG, USDA, which are all particularly funding sources that work in local communities of poverty. We may not have that funding anymore, so it's incumbent on us to make sure that we coordinate every little bit of money we have at the state level so that it makes a difference at the local level. You will note in this testimony that's been submitted that this legislation has the support of the Association of Oregon Counties and the Ford Family Foundation, which is a tremendous partner in our rural areas for addressing leadership-led, community-led efforts in those communities. And Ann Kubisch is not able to be here today. I appreciate the chair inviting her to testify, but you can see her comments.
Can I just add to that?
Yes.
I actually encouraged her not to come because we're on such a tight timetable. Said she could call in, but it was a long way to come for just the 5 minutes that I'd let her speak.
Plus, so. she has some kind of medical problem with her
okay.
too. I urge you to move this bill out of committee so we can continue to discuss it in Ways and Means. And we have one more short panel to present to you. Thank you very much.
All right. So let's hold off on questions and invite the next panel. I see Whitney Grubbs on it, and there are no other names, but come on up. Come on up.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Tate Williams. First, I'd like to thank Representative Reardon for championing this bill. This has been a great opportunity for me to get to know Oregon and how this all works. So I'm a graduate student at Portland State University in the Master's of Public Policy program and intern with Bev Stein's at National Policy Consensus Center. And in that context, I was asked to research the way these communities of concentrated poverty accessed resources and funding both at local, state, and federal levels. So I had conversations with some of the leading experts in these communities, of these vulnerable communities, and explored the challenges that communities faced addressing poverty. In 2015, the Department of Health Services ranked Oregon's top 25 poverty hotspots, also communities of concentrated poverty. Here defined as a census tract with poverty rates of 20% or higher. Working with HUD, we added age, education level, SNAP participation rates, and the percentage of low-income housing in these communities. That list is attached to my testimony. And as Reardon said, Hughes is one of the most impacted communities, neighborhoods. Our research showed that these communities are struggling to overcome multiple layers of social, economic, and educational hardships, and it showed consistent challenges showed that the number one barrier was the capacity to access funding due to lack of staff, skill, and time to perform and report the requirements, requiring many communities to self-select from applying for available funding sources. These communities face significant challenges, but the answer may lay in the communities themselves. Each person interviewed promoted the community wisdom, determination, and self-sufficiency they witnessed as they worked with minimum resources. The innovative and creative ways communities were navigating this difficult terrain was inspiring. The interviews reframed the question from what more can the communities do to what can we as an agency do, and how do we support, guide, and encourage the community work already happening. These discussions emphasize the need to support community-based and community-led solutions. I'm supporting the creation of the Poverty to Opportunity Commission and Opportunity Fund so that we as a state can honor the diversity of our communities while identifying and promoting solutions that create sustainable pathways to success. Thank you for your time, energy, and commitment to this issue.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Whitney Grubbs, and I have had the honor to work in education policy in our state for more than a decade, including as an advisor to two governors, the chief education office, several Oregon foundations, and many community-based collaboratives that are working to improve education outcomes across our state. Through that work, I've seen that improving education outcomes for our state and reducing the vast disparities that exist requires the commitment, perspectives, and resources from multiple sectors. Examples from East Multnomah County, where the All Hands Raised partnership is bringing together DHS workers, school counselors, and teachers to work in teams on reducing chronic absenteeism, to rural Ontario, where coalitions of local businesses, farmers, and educators have leveraged state and philanthropic and private resources to bring career and technical education options back to that community. There is a powerful multiplier effect that occurs when state and local government, philanthropy, and the private sector pool resources toward common goals. And there's a much greater likelihood of powerful and lasting change when solutions come not from the top down, but from the bottom up, through efforts that empower, support, and assist communities in building upon their local assets and opportunities. Frequently, when I ask community members what could better support them to accelerate progress on reducing poverty and improving outcomes for their children and families, they point to barriers at the state level. They question whether the various state and local agencies could better support them by leveraging multiple funding streams, streamlining and aligning their multiple initiatives, making grant processes less burdensome, and helping to build local capacity and know-how. The Oregon Opportunity Commission and Fund create a mechanism through which the state can directly support communities in ways that are responsive to their needs and which evidence has shown us work. I urge your support for House Bill 2534.
Great. Questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2534, open up a public hearing on House Bill 3398. Cassie, could you read the summary? And Representative Reardon.
House Bill 3398 appropriates $150,000 from the General Fund to Department of Human Services to fund the Hunger Task Force. The bill declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the House Human Services and Housing Committee, it's good to be back. For the record, I am Jeff Reardon, and State Representative for House District 48, which includes Southeast Portland, Clackamas, and Happy Valley. I'm here to urge your support of House Bill 3398 and continue funding for the Hunger Task Force. Food insecurity is heartbreaking. When I imagine a parent having to decide between paying for electricity or buying less food, I feel incredible grief. The work that the Oregon Hunger Free Task Force is critical and makes a big difference. The task force started in 1989 when hunger was increasingly recognized as a problem in Oregon. It was created by the state legislature in 1989 to act as a resource and as a statewide advocate for Oregonians who are hungry or at risk of hunger. It has always included legislators from both parties, and it fosters collaboration across sectors. Members include nonprofits like Oregon Food Bank, Meals on Wheels, Oregon State, OSU and Extensions, state agencies, faith healers, Farmers Ending Hunger, and many more. This has had major accomplishments since the 90s, such as connecting more Oregon students with nutritious meals at school, has contributed to an ample drop in Oregon's hunger rate, and helped more families work their way out of poverty, and is closing the hunger gap for children during the summer and after school. House Bill 3398 is simple. It continues the Oregon Hunger Task Force by providing its funding at current funding levels, a very modest amount of $150,000 for the biennium, and it gets the best bang for the buck. We haven't solved hunger yet, folks, and we need to continue this work. They've been great advocates, and I hope you will support this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bruce Weber. I'm Professor Emeritus of Applied Economics at Oregon State University. I'm not here to testify in favor of or against this bill, but really was asked to provide some information about food insecurity and hunger in Oregon. I'd like to make 3 points in the next 4 slides. First point is hunger is and food insecurity are high and rising in Oregon. Second point is that this hunger and food insecurity we find concentrated in certain groups. Renters and households with children are particularly susceptible and vulnerable to hunger. And the third point is that this is as much or more a rural problem as it is an urban problem, which suggests, and all of these things suggest some of the reasons why Oregon might be high and rising, we might see high and rising insecurity. See if I can get this to work. Can I just reach over here and grab this? That'd be better. Thank you. First, just to clarify what we're talking about, food insecurity and hunger. A household is food insecure if it's uncertain of having or being able to acquire the basic food needs of all its household members because of budget concerns. Households that are food insecure will answer the question, the food that we have didn't last and we didn't have the money to get more. They'll answer yes to that question, and that an indicator of food insecurity. A household is hungry or very low food insecure is the way USDA defines this. If one or more members of the household were hungry at least sometime during the past year because they couldn't afford money for food. Families who are hungry, for example, will answer the question that the adults skipped meals or cut the size of their food in order to make ends meet. So this is what food insecurity and hunger are, and the next 3 slides really show us something about both the height of hunger, depth of hunger, and the rate at which it's increased in Oregon. The bubbles on this graph are Oregon's food and insecurity rate over the last 10 years, and we can see that it's been rising. And in recent years, that the U.S. rate has been falling, but Oregon's rate has been rising. Well, it's now true that about 600,000 households last year experienced food insecurity. The hunger rate, which is the lower line, shows that hunger in Oregon has been higher historically and is now moving up again in Oregon. and that about 250,000 households in Oregon were hungry last year. Oregon was the only state last year where there was a significant increase in the number of food insecure and hungry people. What this graph demonstrates is that there are a couple of categories of households that are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity in housing. The chart is set up in a way that that Oregon is on the left-hand side and the U.S. is on the right-hand side. The first column is related to hunger, and the second is related to food insecurity for each of those categories. The bolded and starred numbers indicate that for these categories, both food insecurity and hunger are higher for Oregon than for the U.S., showing, for example, that one-third of renter households in Oregon are food insecure, whereas that's only less than one-quarter of the U.S. renter households are food insecure. So suggesting that one of the causes of food insecurity and hunger in Oregon might be high rent costs, which we know have risen in Oregon fairly substantially over the past couple of years. The second, so the top is renters versus owners. Homeowners in Oregon actually are more food secure than they are in the U.S. The second group on the bottom relate to different household categories, families with children couples with children, single mothers, and single women are all more vulnerable to food insecurity in Oregon than they are in the U.S. Again, because households with children are more food insecure, it's very likely that part of the reason is not just renting costs, which are true for all households, but also child care costs. These contribute, I believe, and the research has suggested at least high rents are a cause of food insecurity and hunger nationally and in Oregon. Disproportionately hits people with children and renters. The final graph here demonstrates, I think, quite clearly which counties in Oregon have the highest rates of food insecurity. And so this is obviously a rural, contrary to the usual pattern where rural food insecurity is lower. In recent years, we've seen higher food insecurity and hunger rates in the rural parts of the state than in the urban parts of the state, which suggests partly, and I believe that the main reason for this is the lack of recovery from the Great Recession in rural parts of the state have caused our rural food insecurity rates to increase. I could talk for quite a bit longer about this issue of food insecurity and hunger, but I'll close here, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, we've got another panel coming up, so unless there's any
Madam
burning
Chair,
questions.
Just one quick question.
Quick answer, please.
On the second slide, I'm just curious because we seem to be in less hunger insecurity during the recession than we are now.
Right.
Why is that?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Meek, that's a good question, and I'm not. I don't think I have an answer for that. But what we've, I don't know.
I would venture to guess that the rents have risen so dramatically in the last few years.
Okay.
Rents were actually suppressed during the recession, when a lot of people were losing jobs, moving back in with parents, doubling up in households.
There we are.
And we've seen such a dramatic, to the extent that a majority of people now, renters, 40% of the state are renters, and a majority are now spending more than 30% of their income on rent. And in many, in particular, five rural counties, have more than 20% of their population of renters are paying more than 50%. So that's a huge, dramatic increase. I would say that's probably the number one reason. That I'm guessing here.
There we are.
I'm guessing.
So look to your chair for the answer to that question.
Thank you so much. Did you want to say one more thing?
Just one more thing. I wanted to add a follow-up to Rep. Meek's excellent question. We've been talking about communities of concentrated poverty. I think it's a good time to really point out, you know, what that means. And in my area, if you look at the job growth since the recession, and you look at Portland Metro, it looks great. We've had over 100,000 new jobs. People are doing well. If you're downtown, if you're east of 82nd, mm-hmm. that community is, their earnings are like $35,000 a year versus 50 across the Portland metro area. We have 49% people of color. We have, I can't remember the number on people in living in poverty, but it's right. so unevenly distributed. So that's part of why you can have people that are going hungry in our areas.
That's right. And Representative Meek and I share the community of Lentz. We're split in two in Portland, which is a low-income neighborhood that in 2015 saw the average rate increase in rent went up 14.4% in a low-income community with suppressed wages. So thank you so much, Representative Reardon. Thank you, Bruce. Can we please have Donalda Dotson, Annie Kirshner, and Mark Connect? With just a reminder to everyone, we've got a lot more bills behind you, so please be brief, and I'm sure that you've submitted everything to OLIS for your testimony as well. Donalda, kick it off.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer-Smith and committee. Thank you for hearing us this morning. I have the privilege of being the chair of the Oregon Task Force, and the Oregon Hunger Task Force is a unique and a privilege, really, that was a legislated body.
Donalda, did you say your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Donalda Dodson, and I am the chair of the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And in Oregon, we have this opportunity to utilize this task force that was created, as Representative Reardon mentioned, by the legislation. The task force is unique in that it is made up of representatives of the Oregon legislature, two from the House and two from the Senate. It's also made up of state agencies and community organizations. And this is a great forum where we can come together to talk about issues related to hunger. It is a forum for the dialogue where we can do idea exchange, where we can leverage of like-minded individuals to do problem solving. And it's the uniqueness of it is that if one organization or entity can do part and another can do another part, by coming together, those parts make a whole. An example of that was the Oregon WIC program was able to assist in getting funds for a senior farmers market program for seniors. So the WIC program took its knowledge and skill and helped create the grant that funded the senior farmers market. So by complementing each other, we were able to bring more resources into the state. The privilege that we have is that this is a legislated body, but it's independent and works within the community. This is unique to Oregon. When we go around the nation and talk about our efforts, they're astounded that we're able to have this unique partnership with our legislation and with our community. And this allows us to have a forum for coordination among partners. We're able to document the extent of hunger and to look at public policy. Hunger is an indicator of systemic issues, as we've heard. It is also a preventable and solvable problem, but it really takes collective efforts. And these collective efforts are reflected in the task force. The task force membership allows for a broader range of thinking and input for the identification of interventions to address the systemic issues in a systematic way. It allows for and encourages a crossover of silos, as we've heard about. So by coming together, we can see some silo busting. It is a conversion of stakeholders who have a like interest, and it fosters stronger collaboration. And all of these efforts are aligned to address the root causes of hunger in Oregon. Some examples of work of the task force, always in partnership, include increased funding for the Oregon Food Bank, school breakfast mandate, Oregon Summit on Hunger, state-funded income tax credit, senior farmers market, the leaning crop tax credit to allow us to take advantage of those opportunities in Oregon. Increased SNAP participation, TANF reform, and the farm-to-school position that is located in the Department of Education. As you can see, this is a broad approach to addressing hunger. So thank you for your time, and I hope that you will continue to support the work of the task force through House Bill 3398, which continues the funding for the very important bipartisan, nonpartisan work and acts as seed money for other funding opportunities. Thank you.
Chair Kinnegar and members of the committee, my name for the record is Annie Kirshner, and I'm the Executive Director of Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, which together with the Oregon Hunger Task Force has the joint goal of addressing the root causes of hunger in Oregon. Thank you for the chance today to speak in support of House Bill 3398, and particularly today as part of our Day of Action on Hunger, so we're joined in the room by many constituents who have traveled to be able to share their own experiences of hunger. I joined the Oregon Hunger Task Force about a dozen years ago as an AmeriCorps volunteer for a year, helping to start new summer meal sites across the state so more kids would have access to meals in the summertime. The following year, in 2006, the Oregon Hunger Task Force had so many initiatives, so many recommendations that it wanted to pursue, that it formed a nonprofit partnering organization, Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, which together has worked to help implement the recommendations over the past decade of the task force. The task force has proven to be a wise investment for the state. Over the past 28 years, it has helped touch the lives of countless Oregonians. When you think about the scale of the issue, that 600,000 number can be daunting. And so the task force has helped put in place solutions that are able to address the problem at that scale. This relatively modest investment, $150,000 a biennium by the state, has helped leverage millions of dollars in private funding to help address hunger and helps draw down every year federal funds through expanded access and participation in nutrition programs like food stamps and school meals. The task force, as mentioned, represents all the sectors in the state that address hunger, and so it's able to react very quickly to changing needs. During the recession, the task force was able to really track what was happening in the correlation between unemployment and foreclosure and that's impact on hunger, and since then has also been able to look at things like affordable housing and health care and how those also track with hunger. Just recently during the snowstorm over the winter, the collective wisdom of the task force was able to help draw out examples of how school closures were meaning that kids couldn't get access to meals, how transportation was keeping people from accessing food banks, and how lost wages from work closure meant that families were then struggling at the end of the month when food stamps ran out. And currently, we are working together to collect the really gut-wrenching stories of families who are living in fear of seeking food assistance because of recent changes and uncertainty with immigration policy. With the rate of hunger continuing to rise, now at the highest rate that it's ever been in the history of our state, the work of the Hunger Task Force feels even more urgent. And this past year, these statistics have really pushed us to dig into the research even further, to disaggregate the data in new ways, including looking at the disparity for people of color and single mothers in particular, as you heard, which in many communities, the rate of hunger reaches half of all people. It's led us to host over a dozen focus groups and hold listening sessions in communities across the state to hear what's happening at a local level and lift up unique solutions that those communities are generating. The task force has pulled together really the best thinking on hunger and just this year released a new plan, which contains recommendations and goals to both look at policies needed to address the root causes of hunger and also what we can do to connect more people to existing nutrition programs. The full set of recommendations was submitted with my testimony, and I'd also encourage you to look at that as well as much more research that was provided by OSU and the task force member Mark Edwards, who was behind a lot of the research. So OregonHungerTaskForce.org was created as a resource for you and the state to go and look more at what the issue of hunger looks like in our state. So just in closing, I hope that our state will reaffirm the declaration it made 28 years ago when it founded the task force, which is that all persons have the right to be free from hunger. Currently, that right is denied to children, seniors, people of color, those with disabilities, single mothers, and Oregonians in rural parts of our state at rates that are disproportionate and that are honestly staggering. So I ask the state to continue the investment it's made to fight hunger and urge you to support House Bill 3398 to continue funding the Oregon Hunger Task Force at current levels. And I'd also invite you to reach out to the task force during session, and particularly if there's questions that you have or information that we can provide. We're here to be a resource for you. I'm happy to answer any of the questions you have.
Thank you so much.
Yes, my name is Mark Knick, and I do a lot of advocacy work for veterans and people with disabilities in this community. And I can remember years ago in a small rural community where I grew up in South Dakota, I used to go up to the courthouse and help distribute the food boxes when they would come in and the trucks would deliver the food. And then, of course, then they did away with that, and then they went to food stamps. And also, it's getting harder and harder all the time for the food banks, too, to keep supplied. And I, once in a while, I do go over and help do things over there. And I want to keep I hope that you have enough funding to keep the meals in the school for these kids. And I don't know if you heard the story of a little boy out on the East Coast somewhere. Poor little boy, he didn't have no money for milk. And so he stole a carton of milk when he was going through the food line. Now, I think that in that case, I think the school could absorb maybe, I don't know what they charge for a carton of milk anymore, but I think the school could absorb something like that. But I do what I can for people here, and I come from a farming community, and I used to belong to the JCs. And what we used to do in that community, some of the farmers would get together, some of the ranchers, and they would take, of course, not one rancher, but several would go together, and they would take the steer into the butcher shop and have it butchered, and then they would, then the butcher would, the meat, the locker service would bundle the meat up in 1 pound packages or whatever, however they did it. And so that's some of the charity that we get from the farmers in the small communities in that area. But
and so Mark, I take it that you support the bill?
Yeah.
You support the continuation of the Oregon Task Force?
Yeah.
Hunger Task Force.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And during the Great Depression, my dad, my uncle always used to say, when the farmer goes, so goes the nation. And we also have to feel, we feel the world, too.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3398, open a public hearing on House Bill 2881, call Representative Huffman up, and Representative Sanchez and Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 2881 appropriates $700,000 from the General Fund to Department of Human Services for the Oregon Hunger Response Fund and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the representative from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I almost feel a lack of need to say anything given the recent testimony, and thank you very much, Mr. Weber, wherever he went, for that amazing slide. We're very clear. We're very clear about the issue of hunger here in the state of Oregon. We're also very clear that the need for things like the Oregon Food Bank and the resources that they provide, not just in food, not just in their ability to distribute all over the state of Oregon, but to provide volunteer opportunities, to provide education about just food in general, growing food, distributing food, all of these different things that they do. And very happy to, of course, support and sponsor this bill, but also to be able to recognize, looking at the number that we asked for, even though over and over again, you know, I've told many, many people, don't ask for a big fiscal, don't ask for money, you know, because right now there's just not. But this is the Oregon Food Bank, and it's $700,000. In the grand scheme of things, from what they've had in the past, it's not a lot. And I feel like you know, given the testimony that just happened and the testimony that we've heard for the last couple of months at this point regarding the increase in rents, the struggles that families are having every day. And I see it all the time in my office. We have food distributions almost every day at NEA Family Center. I know that the issue is huge. And I know that the Oregon Food Bank is one of the best ways that we have as an entire state, because of their statewide distribution capacity, to make some impact here. So I urge your support.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, esteemed colleagues, John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. You got to butter them up first, right, Madam Chair?
Yes, you do, especially when you're asking for money.
You've apparently learned from Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, is it fair to ask questions before I
ask? If you're asking for money, anything's fair.
Just some personal experience. Being a member of Ways and Means for a lot of years, I just wanted to stress to the committee that this is not a new ask. It's money, less money than we've historically done. We'd like to get it added back into the governor's budget for the food bank. That's one thing. So this is not a brand new ask. Mm-hmm. And over the past year, I've had the privilege of doing things like working on an Oregon Solutions project in the Gorge, Mid-Columbia area. Jim Jacks, a former legislator from Vancouver, was the facilitator for Oregon Solutions. And we analyzed food in general in the Mid-Columbia. Where does it come from? Who grows it? How do they market it? Is there a supply chain problem? What's the hunger need? The Oregon Food Bank actually sat in on that with us this past year. And then also my work with the Gorge CCO. And I was sitting in with the Community Advisory Council. And as a part of that process, every CCO does a community health needs assessment. So what I basically wanted to do was encourage each of you. You've heard great testimony about the overall need. You know, we still have food insecurity in Oregon, but I would encourage each of you to check with your CCO and find out where food insecurity is on the community health needs assessment for your region, because I can pretty much assure you it's in the top three or four needs identified in the very current health needs assessment. And then also, if you haven't, check with your local food distributors, your food pantries, and find out what your specific local need is. I think you're going to find out that even though we're considered post-recession, there's still a great need out there. And so this funding 2881, I think, is of critical importance to us this year. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Any questions from the panel? We have another one coming up. Okay, great.
Thank you.
So next is we have Philip Kennedy Wong, Beverly Potter, and Helen Vank.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Committee for Record, Philip Kennedy Wong with Oregon Food Bank. Before I begin, I do want to point out for you our submitted testimony on OLIS. And in particular, there is a table on my submission that shows a summary of all the food assistance programs and what the current biennium funding is, what the one-time funds were, what the governor is proposing, and what Oregon Food Bank Network would like to see funded in order to address hunger in Oregon. The one thing that I do want to call out that hasn't been mentioned as we talk about poverty is the role that the Oregon Food Bank Network plays in emergency management. I do want to call that out because we are in the process of preparing for a large-scale earthquake, and we do play a role in that. So having said that, I do want to give a quick summary of the Food Bank Network and then, introduce my esteemed colleagues here. So we are a 20 regional food bank network, and we provide food statewide that gets to 950 small agencies across the state. And so here to share their perspective on first the regional food bank perspective of what it's like to distribute food at a high level during this time, and what it's like to distribute food directly to clients from the local level. So I have to my right Beverly Potter, who is the executive director of Food for Lane County and also president of the 20-member regional food bank network. And then to my furthest right is Helen Vank, who is with Metropolitan Family Services. They run food programs through the SUN program in the Portland metropolitan area. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Huffman and Sanchez, and to the entire committee for this opportunity to speak to you. Not
you
long ago,
introduce yours. Even though he said your name.
Hi, my name's Beverly Potter, and I'm the director of Food for Lane County and the chair of the network of 20 food banks and a member of the Oregon Food Bank Board. Not long ago, a single mom called our office and asked where she could go to get food. So we directed her to a building owned by Catholic Community Services, where she showed up at the right time during the day and sat in her car and never got out of her car. She watched the activities, but she couldn't get herself out of the door because she didn't want to admit that she couldn't feed her family. So she went home empty-handed, but that didn't solve anything when she got home. So she came back the next day, they were open, and made herself walk in the building. And there she found a very pleasant environment with lots of nice, caring volunteers, and she realized that she didn't really need to be ashamed, that the stigma of asking for help was getting in her way and her pride was getting in the way, but that she really needed help, and she was able to get that, and now she volunteers there, luckily. As you've already heard, hunger in Oregon has increased. We're the only state in the country who has experienced this significant spike in hunger. All the other states have either plateaued at a very high level or maybe a little decreased, but no one has spiked like Oregon. We are serving on average 260,000 people a month using 90 million pounds of food. Our entire state is covered by 20 food banks. We cover every nook and cranny of Oregon. And as you already know, much of our state is rural. So for us in the food banking business, that means we have many communities with fewer grocery stores, higher prices, long distance to travel to buy food, higher prices because of transportation, areas called food deserts where there aren't enough grocery stores where you can walk to them, smaller number of neighbors to ask for food and money, and less opportunity to be able to afford and access fresh produce. The Oregon Food Bank Network wants everybody in our state to have access to nutritional food regardless of where they live. That means refrigerated trucks on the road every day, retraveling to Ontario, LeGrand, Klamath Falls, and everywhere in between to make sure the 20 regional food banks have sufficient fund to feed their neighbors. House Bill 2881, the Oregon Hunger Response Fund, helps all of us, the regional food banks, acquire and distribute food to the 950 community partners that we work with. It also helps us find more food by working with our local communities and working with farmers, producers, distributors, and wholesalers who have surplus to share. It also helps us move our food in a timely manner so it arrives on our clients' tables while it's still nutritious and food safe. Our request of $4 million over a two-year budget is a small investment for a very significant crisis. Food banks are efficient and innovative. We are trusted nonprofits in our communities, but we cannot solve this by ourselves. We need federal and state support, businesses and individuals to support our work out in the communities to fight hunger. When we ask our clients what would need to change in their lives so they would no longer need our services, and we do this frequently, there's three top reasons why people need our help. One, people need a job. Two, they need a better wage. And the top three right now is they need rental of housing they can afford. They used to say they needed affordable health care, but that's been replaced now with affordable rents. It takes all of us to care about our neighbors and to help our neighbors feed their families. Please invest in House Bill 2881 and help us feed hungry Oregonians no matter where they live.
Thank you. Okay, good morning to the chair and to the committee members. My name is Helen Vank. I am the program quality coordinator for Metropolitan Family Service in our community schools department. In 2011, I was a site manager at the Shaver Elementary Sun School, and that's when Multnomah County decided to pilot the school pantry program. We were one of the pilot sites, and at first I thought, what am I going to do with this? I already have a full-time job. I run after-school programs, adult classes, parent events. I connect our parents to resources, and this is just another thing on my plate. What I realized what was unique about the school pantry program is that it enabled me to connect with parents and community members in a more meaningful way. It wasn't long before our parents, our clients that were coming for food, also became our volunteers. As they were volunteers, they took on more and more leadership roles, helping us to improve efficiencies in our pantry, giving us advice on what foods they would like to see, running cooking demos, and even smoothie classes in our schools. At that time, we had a parent who was homeless with her four children after leaving a domestic violence situation. She came to the pantry. She started volunteering at the insistence of her friend. She started taking English classes at the school and soon was able to find a job and get steady employment and find a home for her family. At David Douglas High School right now, we have two teen leadership groups that set up and help distribute food at our weekly pantries there. They're learning skills that are that then part of their group is to learn how to translate those skills into experience on job applications and college applications. Since we began our pantry program at the beginning, Multnomah County wanted to see us serving 40 families at least twice a month. That was at our four school-based pantries. Currently at our four pantries now, MFS in East County serves about 400 families a week. So we've seen the need increase. This year alone at David Douglas High School, the largest high school in the state, we started with about 175 families coming per week, and now we're seeing 220 regularly, and we've hit 240 in a single week. So the need just keeps going up. I just wanted to mention that the school-based pantry model is effective because we're able to leverage other resources at the school. MFS runs financial capabilities programs. We're able to table there. We offer tax help to families that are there and bring in other community resources. So if you can look at these pantry distributions as not just a way to provide food, but also other resources and connections that can get people out of the place where they need to come in the first place. Thank you.
Okay. Quick question, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anybody on the panel, my question is, with all the programs that we're providing, are we giving any education on nutrition and food preparation and ways to stretch the foods and resources you're receiving?
Thank you for the question. I am Food for Lane County in Eugene. We have a nutritionist on staff. We teach cooking classes, how to shop in a grocery store around the perimeter, how to read labels and compare ingredients. We have gardens and farms where we're teaching people how to grow food, how to taste it right out of the ground so they know what it tastes like. And so we're trying from every angle we can think of to help improve the nutritional value of our own food, what we distribute, so we're part of the solution, not the problem.
Wonderful.
And also help people be more self-sufficient and teach them how to manage a budget and how to control their finances so they can cook for themselves and stretch that dollar.
Wonderful answer. Thank you very much.
Great question. Great answer. Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2881 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3160. Is Representative Doherty? She's not coming. Okay. So 3160. We have our own former Representative Gene Cowan. And then we have Chad Ludwig, Mark Connect, and Ruth Ann Lindman, so in whatever order you would like.
Jan is with me.
Okay, come on up. Jan? Yeah, so Cassie, could you read the summary, please?
Thank you.
House Bill 3160 allows an individual who has limited vision to carry and use a white cane on highways and other places. This includes individual who has limited vision, includes individual with limited vision within established offenses for unlawful use of a white cane and for a driver of a motor vehicle failing to stop when the individual with limited vision is crossing a roadway. The bill defines limited vision as visual acuity not exceeding 20/70 and is no worse than 20/200 in the better eye with corrective lenses, and redefines blind to include visual acuity not exceeding 20/200 in the better eye with corrective lenses.
Thank you.
Nice
Chair
to have
Kenny
you back.
Geyer and members of the committee. It's good to be back briefly. My name is Jean Cowan. I live in Newport. I'm happily retired, but was a former representative from House District 10. And today I have with me my good friend and longtime colleague, Ruth Ann Lidman, who you will hear from shortly. The good news is this is a very simple little bill, and it doesn't cost any money. Let's get that on the record. But we would like to offer our thanks to Representatives Doherty and Peluso for their assistance in bringing the bill forward. When Ruth Ann's eyesight started to fail rather dramatically, this is something she's been struggling with for quite some time, she found herself in need of a white cane for assistance with independence and mobility. But unfortunately, or fortunately, because Ruth Ann is who she is, she also researched ORS and discovered that her vision had not yet reached the threshold to be considered legally blind. And so, therefore, she was not eligible to use this assistance device. She'll explain her vision challenges to you, but the changes that are presented for ORS in this bill merely add another category for those who are allowed to reap the benefits of using a white cane to those with limited vision, along with the current standard of those who are blind. It is simply a safety measure to assist drivers in recognizing pedestrians who have significant visual impairments. That's hard to say. With the increased use of electric vehicles, this is ever more important because they're very hard to detect. I've had that demonstrated to me before, and it's rather interesting if you can't hear them coming and you don't see them. Ruth Ann is far from unique. I'm sure that most all of us have heard the term macular degeneration and have had experiences with friends or family, as well as other vision-robbing health issues. So she's going to help you understand that maintaining one's independence and mobility becomes a bit of a challenge when you can no longer drive and navigating on foot is hampered by a visual impairment. This is just a simple, easy step towards making life just a bit easier, and I would encourage its prompt passage. We were contacted about 3 weeks ago by the Association for the Deaf, requesting that there be some verbiage changes in the law that maybe this could be a vehicle for. We said immediately that we had no objection. I haven't seen amendments come through that would do that, so I honestly don't know the status of that particular request. And unfortunately, my technology skills are no better than they were when I was here in the legislature, but I don't have Patrick to do them for me anymore. So my submitted testimony is not in OLIS like I thought it was going to be, but we've worked that out with your assistant, and I will get it on file tomorrow.
So, thank you.
And meanwhile, I'll do a little bit of visual aid while Ruth Ann testifies.
Thank you. I think it goes for my testimony also. It didn't make it in.
Yes.
My name is Ruth Ann Lidman, and I live in Tigard. If you want a complete address, I can do
no,
that.
No, it's fine. Okay.
I'm clearly speaking in favor of House Bill 3160, and I very much appreciate Representative Doherty's willingness to put it together for me. I'm 69 years old. I worked until I was 69. I'm 79. Did I say 69?
Nice try.
Good. I'm 10 years older than you. Okay. I'm 79. I'm not nervous. I'm 79 and in reasonably good health, except a few years ago,
Well, I suddenly started losing a vision in my right eye. It's now completely blind. And shortly after we gave up treating it, trying to stop it, because there is treatment for wet macular degeneration. That's where the blood vessels break. They didn't work. There are three different medications available right now. We went through every one. I have the most rapid descent for macular degeneration that my retina specialist has ever seen. Mm. He was consulting people all over the country and couldn't find something that would stop it. So it's now blind. The left eye decided a few months later to go into dry macular degeneration. Mm. And my combined vision now is measured at 2160. Now, 2020 is perfect. 2200 is legally blind in Oregon. And I'm 2160. That happened over a very short period of time. I won't bore you with the details. Some of them are in my testimony, which you will get a little bit later. I needed a cane because my physical therapist, who I was seeing for a totally different purpose, noticed that I wobbled when I walked. And I'm wobbling because when you lose the vision in one eye, your perspective is different. Objects are not exactly where I think I see them, and when I'm walking, I wobble. So I got the cane. And in spite of the fact, I'm using it because I need it. I'm really very determined to maintain my independence as long as I can. Mm-hmm. I live in the same single-family home that I've been living in since 2000, so I know where things are. I'm in a 55 and older community where other people are helpful. All of my adult children and their spouses and my one of my two grandchildren live within the Portland metro area. So they're very helpful. But I still want to live alone as long as I can.
You want to demonstrate the type.
Yeah, and I do want to demonstrate the type that I can and cannot read. So my original testimony, when it comes to you, the first page is in 28 point, which is looks like this. That's what I can read a few pages at a time now. The second page is what I read on my computer. I now have two 32-inch monitors to work on. As of this weekend, the second one got installed.
So if you please wrap up, I think you've made a fabulous case for your bill.
Okay.
I just need to hear from someone from the deaf community about what their request is, because I think you've made a great case for your bill. So thank you so much. Chad.
Hi, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Chad Ludwig, and I'm the president of the Oregon Association of the Deaf. And I would like to suggest a terminology change from blind and deaf to deaf hyphen blind. We want to have many bills be in compliance and be consistent with a recent amendment to ORS, to the ORS that was passed in March. It was 114-019-0010, and that's 411, correction from the interpreter. So other than that, we do support this bill, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
I think we have the dash one, don't we?
Have you said she's
okay. All right. Thank you so much. I think that was a pretty clear statement as well. Does anyone have any questions about that? Is it in there?
Yeah.
The dash one is in there?
In there.
And that's the dash one.
Yes, it does.
Okay, so Chad, does the tweak. The dash one has the suggested change in terminology that you're happy with?
Yes, it does, and I am happy with that. Representative Olson has a copy.
Okay, and that has been on OLIS for over an hour?
No, we don't have the paperwork on it because we got it yesterday.
Okay, so we would not be so ready to move the bill right now.
We can carry over the work session.
Okay. Is there anyone else to testify in this bill? Mark Connect, would you like to make a quick statement?
Yes.
Thank you very much to the panel. And Mark, if you can keep it short, because we've got a lot of bills to work here. Thank you so much.
I support this bill, and my name is Mark Kinnick, and I support this bill, and I just want to ask one question. We do have books on the, laws on the national books or books reader concerning the ADEA in this matter. I don't know what this bill is about, but I will support it.
Thank you so much.
But can you,
and I know that there's some people back there in the audience that can help you with that. Thank you so much. Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3160, and I'm going to hold over the work session until carryover. I got to have the right terminology on House Bill 3161, and I'm also going to. So I'm going to close the work session on. I'm going to do that separately. I'm going to close the work session on 3160, having carried it over to next Thursday. Okay, now I'm going to close it. I got to identify when that is. I'm also going to open a work session on House Bill 2959 for the purpose of carrying it over to next Thursday because the paperwork is also not ready on that one. So open the work session on House Bill 2959, carrying it over to Thursday, closing the work session on House Bill 2959. And now we are going to proceed with some quick work sessions and use our last 25 minutes here to go through about five bills. Again, I want to encourage the committee, if any of you, because we're going to be starting to do work sessions fast and furious, and I'm going to assume, unless I hear otherwise from my vice chairs, that there are not big issues. We're going to try to fly through them. But if you have issues as you look ahead at the agenda, please tell your work chair what those issues are, because in often case we can deal with those before we come here and answer a lot of questions. If you remain having questions or are against it, that's certainly your prerogative, but it helps me in planning how much time for these work sessions if I know there's a lot of discussion or if there's things that we can answer ahead of time. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2011, and Cassie, could you please remind us what that bill is?
Yeah, so House Bill 2011 directs Oregon Housing and Community Services to administer a study assessing disparities between federal and local fair market rent calculations. The bill establishes the Task Force on Housing Authority capacity to assess housing authority capacity to provide services, determine methods to enhance capacity for housing authorities, and examine feasibility of implementing a state-sponsored housing voucher program. The task force sunsets on December 31st, 2018, and the bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We do have a dash 2 amendment in front of you. The dash 2 amendment removes the declaration of study results, restricts participation from housing authorities serving in the same geographic area included within the federal the fair market rent calculation unless notification of the decision to participate is given to OHCS. The amendment directs OHCS to commission an independent research organization to collect the information necessary for housing authorities to petition increasing the voucher payments, and allows housing authorities to petition to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to increase the value of Section 8 vouchers based on the information from the independent research organization. The amendment allows appointment of representatives of housing authorities and removes task force requirement to examine the feasibility of implementing a state-sponsored housing voucher program and directs the task force to estimate the differences between Section 8 eligibility in Oregon and existing Section 8 resources. We have the fiscal, and the fiscal is $529,045. Because there is a task force, we've been asked to refer it to Joint Ways and Means, and there is no revenue impact.
Thank you very much, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Taylor Smiley Wolf. I'm here on behalf of Speaker Kotek to kindly ask you to pass this out of committee and send it along to Ways and Means. Since Cassie did most of my work for me in terms of reading through the amendments, thank you, Cassie. I just want to reiterate what problem and challenges this bill is trying to solve. So in the speaker's testimony from a few weeks prior, she noted that HUD's calculation of fair market rents are chronically low, so it's making it increasingly difficult for voucher holders to be able to use their vouchers, which is a problem both for low-income Oregonians looking to use those vouchers to secure housing and also an inefficient use of our federal resources because we run the risk of not being able to use those resources again. So that's the first problem. And the second is that housing authorities and the programs that they administer are not adequately resourced. And so we'd like the task force to be able to examine how we can better support administration generally for housing authorities. So with that, I will take any questions. And Ryan Fisher's here as well in case there are questions I can't answer.
Ryan, did you want to make any statement, particularly to the Dash 2? That was a lot of...
Yes, Chair Kenny Geyer,
Vice Chair Sanchez. Can you boil that down for us?
Yes. Vice Chair Olson, I'm really just here to answer questions. Cassidy did a great job.
Okay. Any more questions?
Okay.
You
ready?
Okay.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2011.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment dated March 22nd, 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2011 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2011 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the bill? Okay, any objection? Okay, Cassie. Cassie.
Representative Ashley.
Yes.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Oh, Peluso, excused.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2011 passes to the Committee on Ways and Means. All right, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2011. Open a work session on House Bill 2315. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 2315 allows lender financing affordable housing to receive tenant housing vouchers when claiming the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. This applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018, and is effective the 91st day following sine die. We last heard this bill on March 21st. We have both the fiscal and the revenue impacts, and we have no impact.
Okay. Can I have a motion, please?
Sure. So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2930 with the due pass.
2315.
Okay, disregard.
Here we go. We'll share.
I move that House Bill 2315 to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue be rescinded.
All right. Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2315 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the committee House Committee on Revenue be rescinded. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Borsig?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye. House Bill 2315 passes out of the committee and is on its way to revenue. I close the work session on 2315.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Peluso to enter her vote on House Bill 2011.
Thank you. Vice Chair Stark makes a motion to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Peluso to vote on House Bill 2011. Are there any objections? Seeing none.
Aye.
Okay, aye. Thank you. We'll include, I hope I did that officially, but we're going to include Representative Peluso's aye vote in House Bill 2011. I'm going to reclose House Bill 2011. And.
I'm sorry to carry it for 2315.
What's going on? It's revenue. 2315. All right. Would anyone like to carry 2315? It's the Housing Community Services technical fix. Anyone interested in that?
I'll do it.
All right. Representative Gorsuch, thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Very much. Okay, next up we have this one. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2685. Cassie, you want to remind us what 2685 is?
Mm-hmm. All right. House Bill 2685 requires the Department of Human Services to present an adult with developmental disabilities who is eligible to receive comprehensive services, one placement option, providing assistance to maintain the individual within their own home or the home of an individual's family member. We last heard this bill on March 7th. We do have the fiscal, and the fiscal is indeterminate, and we have no revenue impact. For indeterminate fiscals, we've been asked to kind of determine whether or not it should go on to Ways and Means.
So, Madam Chair, if I could just, looking at the bill, and clearly, members, I clearly understand what this bill is all about. I do have some concern with the placement and isolation of an individual there for DD as well as the IDD population. But to have a mandate, I mean, to direct DHS like this, potentially not having a home, has, I have some concern. So I'm really glad, I mean, honestly, I would be really supportive of wanting to move this down to Ways and Means.
So I want to reiterate what the bill is. So right now, DHS has to offer someone with IDD a placement. They have to offer three placements. And what this says is, in addition to offering, for instance, an adult foster care or a congregate living, that there has to be in that option a home-based setting. And we know that often home-based settings are a lot cheaper because you're relying on natural supports. And when you look up, you can't say that for absolutely every individual, but when you look up the column of support in a home-based setting as opposed to an adult foster care, as opposed to a larger institution, it in general is much cheaper. Every individual case will be different depending on how much support somebody needs. But this is something that the IDD community has feels very strongly that they should at least have an option of being in a home environment. So that's what the bill does. When you see indeterminate, I think it's hard to know how many people will choose that and how, you know, and what the savings or additional costs might be. I think the thought is that there'll be more savings because in general it's cheaper. But anything that has any kind of even indeterminate, with an abundance of caution, we're being asked to send it to Ways and Means so there could be a further look on the financial side of the question. So that is the so let's have a motion, and then we'll see if there's
any
more discussion.
I move House Bill 2685 to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2685 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? All right. Clerk, please call the roll.
Yes. Aye.
Representative Nierman.
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative
Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, House Bill 2685 goes to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2685. All right, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2401. And Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2401 requires Department of Human Services and Department of Justice to provide trauma-informed training and curriculum, including interview models, symptom recognition, assessment tools, data collection, and methods improving placement stability for case planners and other persons involved in child welfare. We last heard this bill, we did the public hearing on February 9th, so towards the beginning of the session. We do have a -5 amendment. The -5 amendment requires Department of Human Services to provide training, including trauma-informed curriculum for child welfare employees, and requires training to include trauma-informed interview models, symptom recognition, assessment tools, data collection methods, improving placement stability, and techniques for children's recovery and resiliency.
The bill specifies that trauma-informed training is subject to the availability of funds at DHS and requires DHS to develop written guidelines for trauma-informed practices. The bill declares the amendment declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017. We have both the fiscal and the revenue impact. There's no revenue impact, and the fiscal is indeterminate.
So, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 5 amendment sent to House Bill 2401.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendment dated March 22nd, 2017. Is there discussion? So this was something we heard a very long time ago. There was a huge amount of support for it, just in terms of the general direction of having child trauma-informed training for many different levels at Child Welfare Department. And a lot of why it's taken so long and had so many amendments is really trying to figure out how we can bring down the cost of training and how much of it is, if you're doing training anyway, this is just a lens, or how much more specific we need to get. And so thank you to Representative Stark and I believe Representative Peluso or Sanchez, can't remember, it's been so long, for the conversations they've had with DHS on really trying to be very specific, as well as Children's Alliance representatives, to be very specific about if there's any kind of cost, what exactly is it for? Because that specificity helps make sure it's the kind of thing we're looking for, and it also helps us follow up a couple of years down the line. To the degree that there's funding put toward this, we want to know what that is and what the results are. So I think the conversations have been really good, but time to move the bill on to the next step.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay,
so
with that said, Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2401 as amended to the floor.
So the amendments.
We need a vote on the amendments.
So that we need a vote on the amendments.
Or agree on the amendments.
Objection to the amendment? Any objection to the amendment, which was the fiscal, you know, trying to pare down the cost?
Good catch.
All right. If seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Now, thank you to my very eager Vice Chair.
I'm not going to say anymore.
Go for it.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2401 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2401 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is an excellent decision as far as trauma-informed investigation, and I will be voting yes. But I have some concerns as to why this even has to be in statute, and that my expectation of why we have the executive branch is to carry out these things and to make these types of decisions without legislative oversight as far as what the best practices and the most effective training is for our staff.
I appreciate that, and I think that I actually think that if there's any money attached to it, it gives more reason for it to go through this body.
Well, absolutely.
So I'm actually not afraid of having any money attached to it, and it's a...
I guess I would say the commitment to fund it, I think, is important that we get involved. Deciding what best practice is and codifying and being so prescriptive, I think, may come back in the future and require this body to.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I know that there's been a lot of talk both in this committee and then in some of the conversations about the bill and about the amendments, about making sure that we talk about training and not curriculum. We have tried very hard to get away from specificity and you know, trying to find that sweet spot in exactly what you're saying. So legislative intent, resources to help the department get there, but not trying to micromanage. So thank you
for
that. Okay, so Ashley, could you please call the roll?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye. House Bill 2401 goes to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I'll close the work session on 2401, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2919. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
House Bill 2919 requires senior community residents providing residential accommodations to persons 55 years or older to notify Oregon Health Authority about provision of food services. The bill directs OHA to adopt rules establishing foodborne illness prevention program for senior community residences and requires OHA to inspect senior community residences annually for compliance with foodborne illness prevention program. The bill also requires persons involved in food services at senior community residences to complete food handler training program. We do have a dash. We last heard this bill on March 16th. We do have a dash one amendment, which we discussed at our March 16th hearing. The dash one amendment changes the entire bill and amends the definition of restaurant establishment to include a facility providing food services at a senior community residence and defines senior community residence. We have both the fiscal and the revenue impacts. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2919.
Okay, Vice Chair also moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 14th, 2017. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Newman.
So, Madam Chair, thank you. I'll be a no on this. I'm not convinced that there's a need for this, and especially, we talk about spiraling costs of health care, and this isn't exactly health care, but these kinds of things. So this is something that maybe we need to think twice about, so I'll be a no on this.
Okay. Representative Meek?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention that as a previous restaurant owner and somebody that has visited some of these facilities, I don't think it's oversight. I think it's protection for some of those attendees or actually residents of those homes. And it's just a very simple process in which the restaurant, but the Oregon Health Authority can license those and keep track and do annual inspections, semi-annual inspections, to make sure that they understand the proper way to disinfect and keep their food safe. And so I think it's a good move, and that's why I'll support it.
Okay. Anyone else on this? Okay. Then, Clerk, could you please call the roll on the amendments? This is on the amendments. Anytime we have not a clear, I'd rather get it on the record. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Representative Borsig?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
This is on the amendment.
This is on the amendment, which is the gut and stuff of the original bill.
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Representative
Geyer?
Aye.
The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Olson?
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2919 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2919 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Borsig?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair
Kucher? Aye. So House Bill 2919 passes, and we'll go to the floor, and we will ask Representative Escobar to carry it. And I believe that is it for our work session. We get out 6 minutes early. Okay, I'm going to close the... We're adjourned. Okay, I'm going to close the...